Boker Tov. I'm sure you realized that we've already read Parshat Shkalim and Parshat Zachor in Shul, and this coming Shabbat is Parshat Para, and then the next week is Parshat Chodesh, and you know what that all means. Sean Kayetz, right. So we will still stick with Sefer HaMitzvot, but limit ourselves to some of the Pesach subjects, beginning with today, with the mitzvah of Tashbitu. Tashbitu is the pasuk in source number 1. Ach b'yom harishon tashbitu se'or mibatechem. We're going to read this already on Shabbat Parshat HaChodesh, in a week and a half's time, from Shmot Perek Yud Bet. And we call it Parshat HaChodesh because of the first pasuk, actually the second pasuk. HaChodesh zeh lachem rosh chodeshim, rishonu lachem lechodshei hashana. The mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh is given there. But the reading of Parshat HaChodesh is 20 psukim long, and a full 18 psukim have nothing to do with Rosh Chodesh. It has to do with Pesach preparation and some of the basic halachot of Pesach. The Gemara actually has two opinions as to how much time would we need for Pesach preparation, and we're not talking about cleaning. I will remind you of what Rav Shlomo Aviner from Bet El said several years ago, and he was almost stoned by women. He said, you only need 4 hours to clean your house for Pesach. And then everybody's saying, one second. Of course he's right. But because, you know, in the Bitul Chametz section that's printed in the Haggadah, where we consciously convert any Chametz that we may not have found into the dust of the ground, Ka'afra, you know, the arad, the afar haaretz. What women have done is they've converted the dirt on the window into chametz. They've made every speck of dust in the house as chametz. And there's nothing wrong with a very good, healthy spring cleaning. Don't get me wrong. And if you want to do that, that's also fine. But in terms of sincerely having the house readied for Pesach, halachically speaking, you really don't have to go, you know, b'shuga. So when the Gemara talks about Pesach preparation, it's talking about reviewing the halachot of Pesach, because there are just so many. There is a poem that was written by a 12th century Ashkenazi poet, Rabbi Yosef Tov Elem. It's printed in many sidurim that still feature the Yotzrot. Yotzrot are poetry integrated into the repetition of Shmon Esrei of Shabbat. I remember as a child in the shtibul that I davened in New York, we said these Yotzrot for Parshat Shkalim and for Parshat Zachor, Parshat Para, Parshat Chodesh. Here in Eretz Yisrael, most shuls don't look at it, and it has a lot to do with the impact of the students of the Vilna Goyim, who felt that all of these additions basically are one oversized hefsek, interruption in the davening, so they shouldn't be said. So those who are staunch followers of the Valojan Brisk type tradition never have any of the Yotzrot. It's interesting that Rabbi Rav Soloveitchik Zichron Livracha said that this was indeed his minhag, except for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Because can you imagine Musaf on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur without Umatana Tokif? It's like, you know, taking the whole neshama out of the Shmon Esrei. I mean, you have the definition of the Kedushat Yom, Natana Tokif, Kedushat Yom, the Tokif, the real force of the sanctity of the day is defined by the poet who writes the Natana Tokif, and so many other parts of the Machzor of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So you see that the Rav, albeit belonging, you know, subscribing to this Valojan / Brisk tradition, would be independent if he saw otherwise, and he felt that there would be missing something. But the other piyutim he never said, and here in Yerushalayim we don't say the piyutim for these extra yotzrot. But in the sidurim that still have it printed, so there's a long poem, I mean a really long poem, to be said in Shabbat HaGadol, at the end of Shacharit. It begins with Elokeya Ruchot Lechol Bazar, and it's really a poem that takes the entire laws of Pesach from beginning to the end, from A to Z, in a poetic fashion. very similar to what Rav Sadia Gaon did with the 613 mitzvot called Azharot, that the Sfaradim say it till this very day on Shavuot before Kriyat HaTorah. So it's a very good educational tool, because something that's a poem, so it has rhyme, it has meter, it has a certain rhythm to it. It's something that you can remember by heart, which is the very, very point of poetry. Not only does it express a certain emotion, because it's a feature, it's a form of art, no doubt, poetry, but it also allows people to remember things by heart. And, you know, most of these Zmirot and Shabbat, so today, you know, everybody has 5,000, you know, Zmirot books, because they were given these benches at the weddings. They don't even know what to do with them anymore. And then you ask me the question, what should I do with it before Pesach? This is last night in my shul, I gave a whole shiur about what do you do with extra things in the house? You know, you just don't need any longer. Nobody needs another 10,000 benches, you know, because they have their own 10,000 benches at home. So, but that wasn't always the case with Zmirot. So these Zmirot that were composed as poetry would allow people to remember them by heart and be able to sing them and say them by heart. So this is very, very, very important. So Rav Yosef Tov Elam really has this long poem. You see that there's a tremendous amount of detail in the laws of Pesach, that even someone who's gone through Pesach often enough, you know, there's always something new that you pick up. Ein bet midrash lo chidush. You always hear something new, and the review is always worthwhile. So the Gemara says, Sholim v'dorshim b'lchot Pesach kodem ha-Pesach shloshim yom. You begin to inquire, ask your annual shaylas, your questions, a month before Pesach. After Purim, that's when it's Pesach question time. And then there's a second opinion. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, Shtei Shabbatot. Shtei Shabbatot means Shvuayim, means 2 weeks. You don't need a full month. 2 weeks is adequate. And I believe that the whole invention of Shabbat Parshat HaChodesh is in conformity to that second view, because Parshat HaChodesh is always about 2 weeks before Pesach. So that's when we're reading Shmot Perek Yudbet, which essentially is the subject matter of Erev Pesach and Pesach. Most of the requisite halachot are there, in those 18 psukim of the 20 that we read for Shabbat Parshat HaChodesh for the Maftir. But we know that Purim does become somewhat of a signal for those who have the minhag not to eat matzah from Purim 30 days before Pesach. Now the halacha is that you're not allowed to eat matzah on Erev Pesach, but there are two different minhagim. There's a minhag from Rosh Chodesh, which is 2 weeks before Pesach, and there's a minhag from Purim, a month before Pesach. And most probably those two minhagim are linked to the machloket. How long do you need for Pesach preparation in terms of your study? Do you need 2 weeks or do you need 4 weeks? And the Gemara says that where did the 4 weeks come in? It was just an arbitrary number. So there's an interesting halacha that if somebody goes away for Pesach, but doesn't leave at the last minute, leaves 3 days before Pesach, 4 days before Pesach, but he's not going to be home for Pesach at all. So does that person have to do bedikat chametz? So the halacha is that the night before he or she leaves the house, you have to do bedikat chametz, albeit without a bracha. The only time you say the bracha is on Yud Dalet Nisan, which would be the eve of Erev Pesach. But if you do bedikat chametz on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, you can do bedikat chametz, but without a bracha. But there's an obligation to do bedikat chametz. But what if somebody's leaving the house on Chanukah, in the Kislev? He's coming back in the summer. Why? You know, some people have a winter home, a summer home, whatever. And you know, somebody leaves in the beginning of in the English calendar, end of November, December, and comes back home in May, June. He's not going to be home for Pesach. So there, the Gemara says, there's no obligation in Chodesh Kislev to do bedikat chametz. So that when you study the Gemara, what's the difference between 30 days before Pesach, where within 30 days you do have an obligation to do the bedikat chametz, and it's beyond 30 days, you're exempt. So Gemara says, because of the halacha of sholim v'dorshim bilchot Pesach kodem Pesach shloshim yom, that a person within a month before Pesach is obligated to get involved in the study of the restudy, review of the laws of Pesach, so Pesach's on your mind. Nobody has Pesach on his mind on Chanukah. At least you shouldn't. You have to have sufganiyot on your mind. That's good chametz, you know, that's very good. But Pesach's not on our minds in Chodesh Kislev or Tevet or Shvat. It's on your mind after Purim because of the halacha of Sholim v'dorshim bilchot Pesach. And once Pesach is on your mind, so issues of chametz and matzah are on your mind. Just yesterday I was in the supermarket, the local supermarket, just to pick up some local items, what do I see in front of me? Matzah shmura. I mean, they already delivered the matzahs to the supermarkets pretty early, I think. No, a few days after Purim. Usually, yochel me rosh chodesh. But here, the matzahs were already, you know, and they're already setting up the Pesach, you know, shelves for all the various products. And you know, once upon a time, you had to go to particular Haredi neighborhoods to get Pesach products. But today, you go to any supercell, you go to any local co-op, you get everything. Mamish everything, all with the good hashkachos, and also, you know, you don't have to compromise on anything. It's wonderful. But this happens after Purim. No, you know, it's like they set up Hamantashen right after Hanukkah, and they set up Sufkaniyot right after Sukkot. I mean, you know, like, so it's, right, you have to be ahead of the game, right, for sure. So, but here, after Purim, the next thing on our agenda is Pesach. So that's the interesting halacha of Sholim V'Dorshim. So the pasuk says in that section, Ach b'yom rishon tashbitu sa'or mibotechem. But on the first day, you should devour sa'or is a nickname for chametz, from your homes. What do you mean the first day? First day of Pesach, that's when you clean your house for chametz? That seems to be a little bit too late, no? You missed the boat. So Gemara talks about that. That this Bayom Rishon doesn't mean the first day of Pesach, it actually means Erev Pesach. How that works, it's intellectual gymnastics. How the Gemara figures out that it cannot be Pesach, it's Erev Pesach. So from a halachic point of view, on the noontime of Erev Pesach, your house has to be cleaned from chametz. And that has something to do with the bringing of the Korban Pesach and days of Beit HaMikdash. The time framework for the offering of Korban Pesach theoretically begins at noontime, on Erev Pesach. Once you already have the possibility of offering Korban Pesach, the house has to be already spick and span, clean, from chametz. Lo tishchat al chametz dam zivchi, the pasuk says in Parshat Mishpatim, Chazal say, lo tishchat al Pesach ve'adayin chametz kayam. Do not slaughter the Korban Pesach, and there's still chametz around. You cannot have chametz around any longer. That's from a biblical point of view. So before then, in order that your house is clean from chametz, so before noontime, you better make sure you have no chametz. Okay, so what is the word tashbitu? What do you think? Take a look at the word taf, shin, bet, yud, taf, vav. Underlined and accentuated. What is the shoresh? What is the root? Shabbat, which means cessation, right? So it means cease to. So it's in the context of Shabbat, means to cease to work. So onkulos in Sorosos number 2, Beram Beyoma Kadma'a Tevatlun Chamira Mibatechem. We're familiar with the word Chamira. Kol Chamira Vachamia Di'ike Bershuti. You don't have to say it in your Kumpurkan language. You can say it in pure Hebrew as the Rinat Yisrael Siddur and Machzor translated to Hebrew. Kol Chametz. That's all. You have to understand what you're saying. This is not the cryptic, mystical language here. It's very simple. It's a declaration that chametz that I did not find, so I'm just making it hefker, just making it free-for-all, and it's not mine. And the question is, what does that help if it's not mine? So the word tashbitu is defined in Aramaic as tivatlun. The shoresh is bitul. What does bitul mean? But cancel. So the question is, cancel what? Cancel ownership? Could be cancel ownership. Because if you take a look at, where do I have it on this list? One second. That's very good. I'm sure I have it somewhere. One second. If you look at the second page on top, first page on the bottom, source number 10. First page on the bottom. It says, Tanu Rabbanan, the Gemara Mezerub Sachim Dachay brings a braita. Shivat yamim sa'or lo yimatzei bevatechem. For 7 days, the chametz, sourdough. Sa'or means, we used to translate in Yiddish, zayrteg. It means sourdough. But it means chametz, in this case. It's an example of chametz. For 7 days, it shall not be found in your homes. Ma Talmud lomar, v'alo kvar ne'emar, lo yera'el lecha sa'or, v'lo yera'el lecha chametz b'chol gvulecha. The Torah already told us in Parshat Bo that you're not allowed to have seen chametz in your property, in your boundaries. B'chol gvulecha. So why does the Torah have to tell us shivat yamim sa'or lo yimatzei bevatechem? So you're not allowed to see chametz or have it seen. You're not allowed to have it found. Lefi she'ne'emar, because it says lo yira'eh lecha se'or, shelcha i ata ro'eh, yours you're not allowed to see. Aval ata ro'eh shel acherim v'shel gavoa. But if it belongs to others, here others means goyim. Others doesn't mean a Jew. Here acherim, it's a code word. It means goyim, or it belongs to Hekdesh, belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which means it's not yours. What that means is that when the Torah gives us a double-edged prohibition, bal yira'eh and bal yimatzeh, which means chametz should not be seen in your house, it should not be found in your house. Seems to be semantics. But they're two different things, but you always get both averus. You cannot violate one without the other. Because even if the chametz is not visible because it's covered by 100 blankets, but it's in your house, and all I have to do is lift the blankets and I can find it, so it's something that I can find, you automatically get a bonus. You get the second one for free. So you always get two averot. So it could be bal yira'eh and not bal yimatzeh, or bal yimatzeh and not bal yira'eh, but in your file, you get two demerits. Now you're going to say, okay, thank you, so I got two averos. What's that going to help me? The answer is, in the days that there was a Beit Din, that gave Malkot, so if you happen to have purchased chametz, let's say on Chol HaMoed Pesach, or you baked chametz on Yom Tov or Chol HaMoed Pesach, you are in violation of these two averot that you'll get Malkot, because you did a positive act. As opposed to simply not cleaning your house for Pesach and having real chametz in your possession, you get the double averot, but there's no malkot. Why? Because you did nothing. To receive malkot in Beit Din, it has to be an action. Lav sheyesh bo ma'aseh. And a passive act is not considered an act at all. It could be an avera, but it's not an act that brings about malkot. So if you just didn't clean the house from real chametz on Pesach, and it's in your possession on Pesach, you do get both averot, but it's without penalty in a Beit Din. But if you purchase chametz on Chol HaMoed, or baked chametz on Yom Tov for Chol HaMoed, then indeed it's with malkot. So today there's no malkot, it's a big deal. The answer is, how do you deal with this on Yom Kippur? On Yom Kippur, if a person knew that he or she violated Bal Yirel Bal Yimatzeh, how many confessions, vidui, do you have to have on Yom Kippur? So the answer is two. One for Bal Yira'eh and one for Bal Yimatzeh. It's two different averot. But I say again, you can never violate one without the other. Kadosh Baruch Hu gives us, it's two for the price of one. That's what it is. It's a bargain, right? It's a real metziah. So the Torah teaches us, lo yira'eh l'cha chametz. If Torah just would have said, 7 days chametz shouldn't be found in your house, we would have understood any chametz. Doesn't make a difference whose chametz. Then the Torah comes up and says, no, lo yira'eh l'cha chametz, your chametz. That already triggers the idea, if it's not yours, but here, the not yours cannot be another Jew's chametz in your house. Another Jew's chametz in your house is an issue. But if it's a goy's chametz in your house, you are not in violation of bal yira'eh bal yimatzeh. That doesn't mean you can eat it. Of course you're not allowed to eat it. But you don't violate this double avera of bal yira'eh bal yimatzeh because it's not yours. This is the loophole of sale of chametz that we all do. And that has a history to it, because the Gemara doesn't tell us that daughter of a shul rabbi, a local rabbi, or whatever, Moitza Datit, that's something that has a history to it. Rav Zevin, in his Sefer Mo'adim Balacha, has a whole chapter on the history of mechirat chametz, because it began essentially in the Middle Ages, and people had big stockpiles of whiskey. And that's real chametz. Beer and whiskey. And Jews in Europe dealt with alcoholic beverages. That was their big business. Now you're going to tell them to destroy all of their stockpile. They're just not going to do it. There had to be some ingenious idea that's going to allow these people to survive Pesach without being in violation of Bal Yira'eh Bal Yimatzeh. So the idea was to sell it to a goy. He said this was only for limited practice for those who had large stockpiles of chametz. But as what happens to many minhagim, it has its own dynamics. So once it's good for you, it's good for me, and it's good for everybody, and so on. But you know, the original mechiras chametz was that they gave the goy, not only the goy give money to pay for the chametz, But they gave him access. They gave him the key to the factory or to the storage house, and he really could come in and take it because it was his. I mean, we tried, the halakha tried very hard not to make it into a fictitious sale, even though we all knew that after Pesach, the suggestion is going to be made to the guy to sell it back to the Jew, and of course he's going to cooperate, and he'll get a few bottles of whiskey for being a nice cooperative camper. But what ultimately happened was it didn't turn out to be a good idea to give the key to the goy because keys can be duplicated. So then they decided that the goy will agree that the key will be given to the neighborhood rabbi, the city town rabbi. And then it turned out that that wasn't such a good idea either. You laugh. You laugh. It's very, very sad. Very sad. You know, there's a reason why Coca-Cola will not tell the OU the exact ingredients of Coca-Cola. You know, Coca-Cola has the OU. You don't see it on the label. That's because they're chayshish be'enabisha for ayin hara. You know, they don't want some certain elements in the United States to see that they support a kashrus organization. But how can you have a hashgacha on something that you don't know what's in it? There's a secret formula. So, of course, so the answer is, and this I was told that what they do is, just as an arbitrary number, let's assume there are 40 ingredients in Coca-Cola to make the Coca-Cola, and that's a secret formula, they will bring into the plant 10 times that number of ingredients, 400 ingredients, and have the OU be machshir, say, yes, all these 400 are okay. What's the difference if they don't use 90% of it? They use 10% of the ingredients, but all 400 were kosher for Pesach. So that's how they do it. And they will not give out the secret ingredients to the OU. For the same reason that we stopped giving the key to the rabbi. And then they realized that that all you had to do was write an address and where the chametz is placed. Today, we don't even do that, most rabbis. They don't even write to itemize that it's in this room, in this closet. It's simply an address. And it says that the goy is invited to come at a normal hour. He's not going to show up at 3 in the morning, but he's allowed to come, and you have to provide him entry to his chametz. That's what it says in the Shtar Mecher for Mechuyat Chametz. That's the bottom line, what's done. But it all begins with the drasha that we just see now in source number 10. Shelecha i'ataro'eh, aval atare shelecherim. You can't have your chametz, that's your, you own it, in your possession on Pesach, but it belongs to a goy in your house on Pesach. It's not an issue of bal yireh bal yimaseh. I say again, you're not allowed to eat that chametz, but you're not in violation of bal yireh bal yimaseh. So now, if you flip this page to source two, to source number 11, so Rashi says on the Gemara that talks about betel chametz. Rashi says, "Dichtiv tashbitu," that the Torah says, "Tashbitu." V'lo katuv tiva'aru. Biur means a physical getting rid of the chametz. Bitul is something more in the mind of distancing yourself in terms of being the owner of the chametz. Hashbata belev hi hashbata. It's simply belev means it's a conscious decision that this is no longer my chametz. If the Torah wanted that you should physically clean your house and get the chametz out of your house on Pesach, it would have said so. It would have used an expression of tiva'aru. But the Torah uses the word tashbitu. As Unkel is translated, tivatlun, bitul. Bitul suggests it's just a conscious decision. So from a biblical point of view, that's all you have to do, is make a conscious decision that this is no longer my chametz, and at least on the bal yireh bal yimaseh factor, you're okay. Chachamim made a institution called Bidikat Chametz, search your house for Chametz the night before Erev Pesach, and on Erev Pesach, burn whatever you found. So there's machloket, they have to burn it, or you can get rid of it other ways. So the minhag is, the halacha is, by the way, you can get rid of it other ways too. You can, let's say, throw it in the ocean, or flush it down the toilet. That's also Biur Chametz. But the minhag is to burn the Chametz. Fine. Just don't burn down the whole city with, in the process. You have to be careful, also be safe about this. But that's what we do midrabanan. But the bidoraita, from a biblical point of view, the bitl is enough. Fine. In source number 12, The Tosfot, Omer Ri, Ri is Rabbeinu Yitzchak HaZaken, one of the great Balei HaTosfot, Midoraita beBitul b'Almasagi, that from a biblical point of view, Bitul is enough. Mitam de me'achar shebitlo havi hefker. When I disassociated consciously, I said, this bread, not mine. So what does that mean? Translate that now into halachic language, lingo. Hefker. Hefker means no ownership. Who owns it now? Nobody. Hefker, it means something that does not have ownership. Finished. As simple as that. I have relinquished title to this bread. So it's not mine. Does it belong to anybody else? No. But it's not mine. So therefore, shelcha iyatar v'ayah. Because it's not mine, I have not violated anything. V'yatza mirshuto. It left its dominion. It is rishut. Umutar midkamrinan avalataru esh alachirim shel gavoa. Fine. So this is the way Tosfot understands that the way the bitul chametz works, because it invokes a halacha of hefker. In source number 13, and I'm not going to belabor source number 13, because I will tell you that when I studied Masechet Pesachim with the Rav back in 1974, the Rav spent at least 2 shiurim on this Ramban, which I only have part of it on this page here. It's a very lengthy section of the Ramban, and the Rav was in love with long Rambans. I mean, those are the things that gave him a real charge. A long, complex Ramban. And, you know, he would deal with it for hours, in shiur, you know, with the Talmidim, breaking their heads and to figure out. So I cheated here. I just gave you some of the bottom lines. You know, what comes out of it. So if you take a look at the source 13, you see dot, 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 because it's already out of context there. It's cut and pasted here. On the second line, underlined, it says, V'lo tehe rotzeh b'kiyumo. That the way Ramban understood, Rashi's understanding, I don't want it to be in existence. That's what Beetle is. Not my business that it exists. The fact that in reality exists is of no consequences. From my point of view, it doesn't exist. But if you look further down in Source 13, 3 lines from the end, on the line, Achametz bizmano, mamon avudhu mi ba'alav. How does it work that all of a sudden something becomes hefker? Becoming hefker is a procedure. It's not just, all right, I have a pen in my pocket. All right, it's hefker. I don't own it. Did it become hefker? It's still in my pocket. Can anybody, you know, get a hold of it? Has it been publicized that's free for all? I just thought in my mind, I have a pen in my pocket. I don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to have any, you know, I'm brothers with my pen, right? My pen wrote a bad article. It wasn't me. My pen wrote the bad article. So I'm brothers with my pen, and I don't want to have anything to do with my pen. So the Ramban says, that has no validity. Hefker? There's a way to make things into hefker. It's a declaration in front of 3 people. That's how you make things hefker. I'll give you a very nice idea. I mean, this is a novel, ingenious idea that the Rav had once with regard to Tfilat Kelim. Tfilat Kelim, which is a halacha in itself, I don't get into the whole details, but what happens if you have an electric instrument that has metallic parts to it, like a toaster and a blender and stuff like that? And it seems that from the laws of Tfilat Kelim, it's metal and should be toiveled and so on. So people say, all right, take it apart and toivel the metal parts to it. There's a very interesting principle in Tvila, whether it has to do with Kelim or human beings. It's an all or nothing deal. There's no such thing as 99% toivel. Either you toivel 100% or you toivel 0, right? So you can't toivel something partially. You can't hold a kli halfway upside down, and then turn it again halfway, and said, I toiveled the kli. No, the kli has to be completely submerged in the water. So to a human being. I mean, it may sound a little funny, but let's assume a man or woman goes into the mikveh and stands on 2 feet, but that it's only waist high. And then you know, do a headstand. So, you know, you toiveled the other half of your body. That's not tefillah. Tefillah has to be completely submerged. Completely submerged. And that was the reason that there was a need for Balanit to see that all the hair is submerged also, and so on. So the idea of Tefillah Kalim, by just taking apart, like Tinkatoy, some of the parts, and then putting it back together, but the Kli wasn't toiveled, really. Because you're only toiveling part of the Kli. Now, okay, so I'm going to put my toaster into the oven. Don't plug it in when you... I'm going to put it into the mikveh, rather. Don't plug it in while you're doing that, because it's going to be a shocking experience. And you most probably won't live to see the results. So don't do that. But some people will do that, and then they'll hang it out to dry for a week. And what's going to happen is the first time you plug it in, you blew out your electricity. It's going to short out the whole house. It's not... You're going to ruin the thing. You're going to ruin the thing. So what do you do? So there's some poskim who say, you do nothing. That's what we mean, do nothing. But let's assume you feel it should be toiled. So the Rav said, very simple, Tefillat Kelim is only a kli that you acquire from a non-Jew. If you bought a kli from a Jew, there's no halacha of Tefillat Kelim. Because Tefillat Kelim means it's an act of conversion, giur. Just like a human being converts from being a non-Jew to a Jew, the non-Jew's vessels convert to becoming Jewish vessels. It's an act of giur. So that's why here in Israel, if you buy products, metallic product, you know, kelim, pots and pans, or silver, that's local, there's no tefillat kelim. It's only the imports that you have to worry about and deal with tefillat kelim. That's aloha.
But if they're local, then they have the heksher. But that's a pans.
You don't need a heksher for tefillat kelim. If it's made in Israel, you don't have, and it's a Jewish company. If there's a heksher on an aluminum pan, is they're trying to tell you that there was no oils smeared on it.
I thought it because it was made in Israel.
No. What?
Aluminum pans, and right. They have oils smeared on
it. Some, they used to. They used to.
But does it today make they a don't. Sign that they were made here?
It says in, it's Mishrabi says on the, Mishrabi says on the back, I don't need the badats to tell me halacha. I know the halacha. If it's made in Israel, and it's a Jewish company, and we know the names of the companies in Israel, they're famous, there's no need for Tefillat Kelim. So what did the Rav say? What do you do in a scenario, if you have a pot or pan, or a knife, or four spoons, and you have to use them for some function, and there's no mikveh? You know, and you just feel you can't serve plastic forks now. This is a fancy shower brachas coming up here. And just bought a new set of cutlery. What do you do? So can you use the fancy set of cutlery that you feel important guests are coming, and you don't want to give them plastic spoons and knives, which I can understand. So Rav said he whips out a very interesting halacha. And that is, because it's only kelim acquired from a goy that requires a tefillah, kelim acquired from hefker are also exempt from tefillah. If you just found kelim on the street, and they just don't belong to anybody, and you picked it up, right? Like the guys who go around, and they collect from the garbage bins and all kinds of things, and people throw out a lot of good, usable things. And there are people here in Israel, Jew and non-Jew alike, who fetch them, because it's worth, you know, they can still use it for something. So if you acquire a kli from Hefker, there's no obligation of tefillat kelim. So Rav said, In these kind of unusual circumstances, like electrical appliances that you're not going to put in the mikveh anyway, or a circumstance of shat atchak that you want to use something but you don't have an opportunity, you don't have a mikveh in the neighborhood, he says you can invite three people, and in front of three people, declare them hefker. You do this outside, and you leave it on the front door, and you close the door, and you walk away from it. You made this declaration in front of three people. Now, if these three people... then, you know, pick it up and take it home, it's your loss, because they're allowed to do it, because it's Hefka. But if they know that they were invited to be the three, to form the kind of beitin, to declare the Hefka status, in all likelihood, they're not going to walk away with it. But you just hope that 10 minutes later, nobody else walked away with it. You open the door, wow, look what I have on my doorstep, a nice electrical appliance, you know. Then nobody, does it belong to anybody? Nobody here? Nobody? It's mine. So you acquire from Hefker. So the reason I bring this example, because the Ramban says, you can't just say, oh, it's Hefker. Hefker is a procedure. It's a halachic procedure. So what else can we whip out from the halachic repertoire that's going to make something not mine, the cancellation of ba'alut, of ownership. So that Ramban brings us to Masechet Baba Metzia, with many yeshiva boys learning, 5th grade or 6th grade, 2nd perek, Eilu Metziot Shelo Ve'Eilu Chayav La'achriz, the halacha of Hashavat Aveda, a lost item. And a lost item, so Am Yisrael does not function with the phrase founders, keepers, losers, weepers, but there's a mitzvah of Hashavat Aveda. But the mitzvah of returning lost articles also carries with it certain limitations where, what are you going to hang on to it for 1,000 years? If it's something that has no identifiable inscription on it, and it's in a place where, in all likelihood, the person who lost it has given up hope of ever receiving it back, then it becomes yours. That's called Ye'ush. And the only discussion in the Gemara is, at what point, let's assume a person lost a pen. The only thing is, that when the person lost the pen, the person didn't know that he or she lost the pen yet. It's going to take 3 hours, the person has to sign a check, hey, where's my pen? Now, in the interim 3 hours, somebody found it. Now, let's assume at the end of the 3 hours, the person says, Tov, you know, as they say in the Moroccan Jews, kapara, right? Kapara, you know, it's finished. Or, that's it. You know you're not going to see this pen again. But you said that after 3 hours. But within the 3 hours, somebody else found it on the street because you had a hole in your pocket and it fell in the, and it's just a standard pen like anybody else's pen, and you'll never get it back. There's no way you're going to get it back. So the question is, had you known 2.5 hours ago that you lost the pen, of course you would have said, forget it. But you didn't. You know now 3 hours later. But in the interim, somebody found it. That's called Ye'ush Shelo Mida'at. Is there a concept that you gave up hope of ever finding it before you even knew that you lost it? So you look at source number 14. I mean, this is classic. Ye'ush Shelo Mida'at. I'm giving up hope. Ye'ush means I give up hope. I'll never get this back. But it's Shelo Mida'at. I didn't even know I lost it yet. But when I find out that it's lost, of course I'm going to give up. But in the interim, somebody may have found it. So Abaya says, Lo have Ye'ush. That's not called Ye'ush. Ye'ush means that you know that you lost it and you gave up hope. So until the moment of recognizing that you lost the article, there can't be any Ye'ush kicking in. And Rava says, Have Ye'ush. It is considered a giving up. Now what's interesting is that in 99% of the disputes between Abaya and Rava, the halacha is Kerava. Rava is the dominant. But there are 6 exceptions to the rule. And they're abbreviated by the abbreviation Ya'al Kegam, Yud Ayin Lamed, Kaf Gimel Mem, Kuf Gimel Mem, and the Mem, the Yud of Ya'al is the Ye'ush Shelo Mida'at, where the halacha is like a baye, not against Rava. And just an interesting anecdote: when Arav Lichtenstein, Zichron Lebracha, Rabban Lichtenstein, when he was still in his young prime here in Israel, he used to go to the high schools, or the high school kids would come and be interviewed by him to enter into Yeshivat Har Etzion. And those bechinas were murder. So there was a group of fine boys coming from the Bnei Akiva Yeshiva here in Beit Vagan, Nativ Meir. And first question, he asked one boy, can you tell me what Ya'al Kigam is? The guy looked at him like, he looked at Rav Aaron, you don't know what you're talking about. What's Ya'al Kigam? Never heard of it. Never heard of this abbreviation. Rav Aaron just sent him home, says goodbye. That's all, I want to look at you. Why? Because Rav Aaron said, if he doesn't know what Ya'al Kigam means, that means he never learned Bab Metzia, he never learned Sanhedrin, he never learned Gittin, he never learned Kiddushin, he never learned any of the Gemarot, that any of these 6 exceptions played a role. He never heard of it. It indicates that some of the famous Masechtot that are studied in the junior high school level and high school level, he's never touched. So what's he learned? What kind of baggage is he coming along with? He never heard of Ya'al Kigam. Can you imagine? Because he felt that I heard of Ya'al Kigam in 6th grade when we learned Bab Metzia. It was because Rashi spelled it out, what the 6 were. Yal is Yesh Min Lomidat, Ayin Eid Zomim Lomafreo Nifsal, and so on. Lama was Lechi, is a Shesugia Mesedet Erevin, and so on. And Meseda. So Ye'ush means that you consciously give up hope of ever getting it back. Yeah?
On the other part of Ya'al Kegam,
Yeah. Besides the yud, related to avedot?
No. Each one is an independent sugya. So what Rav Lichtenstein wanted to know, did you learn this Gemara? Did you learn this Gemara? Did you learn that Gemara? You didn't learn any of them? And you're coming here to Yeshivat HaRetzion? Sorry. I can imagine. That's why in Chashmonaim I made sure those kids knew what Yalke Gam was. Yeah, I'm sorry.
It could be that in our generation, are people remembering and memorizing the way they once did?
That's a good question anyway, because people today, I say with great sorrow and nostalgia, that the way kids are studying today differs somewhat. But nevertheless, the familiarity with certain things that are so famous in the Gemara should stick in the head.
Well, with all the technology we have.
I understand what you're saying. I understand.
Everything comes so easy to kids today.
That's correct.
When in your day you had to memorize.
Had to memorize things. Like my bar mitzvah's 20 minutes Russia. Right. I had to memorize it and spit it out. That's right. And I had a cousin that came over to me after the bar mitzvah Russia, and he says, you're going to be a rabbi or a politician. Uh-huh. I told him, it's the same job.
They both go to jail.
They both go to jail.
Sorry. How many rabbis go to jail?
Let me tell you something. That was good. Yeah. All right.
That one really hurts.
What?
That one hurts.
Yeah, of course it hurts. Of course it hurts. What are you talking about? All right. So the Ramban, at the end of source number 13, he figures out that there is a framework that can bypass the halachic prerequisites of hefker and nevertheless have the person distance himself or herself from the chametz, and it's called yeush. Yeush, when a person says, oh, where's my pen? Oh, forget about it. I'll never get this pen back. You don't have to convene three people to make that declaration. That's just a feeling of, it's all over. I'll never see this pen back again. That's called Yeush. And the Ramban feels that this is an expression of Yeush. Which is interesting, the way the Rishonim are really trying to figure out, you know, exactly why, how the mechanism of Beitul Chametz works. So if we go back to the first page. First, what was that? On source number 7. So source number 7 is the very opening Mishnah of Masechet Pesachim. Or la ba'asar botkin et chametz lo aner. On the eve, the word or in this case means the eve of, the 14th of Nisan. We search for chametz by candlelight. Komokom she'en machnisim bo chametz. Ein tzarich bedika. Any place in your possession that you're absolutely certain chametz was never brought into this place at all. So you don't have to search for chametz. So let's say in my car, I do have to search for chametz. Why? Because I have kids and grandchildren who's it? You know, there's always some, you know, bisli and bambas. Bisli mela is bisli is chametz. Bambas, kidney, who cares? But bisli is chametz. I mean, there's always something under the shtetiach, under the rug. You have to clean the car for Pesach. That's no question about it. But let's assume you have a machsan. And the machsan is only for hardware, you know, tools and stuff like that. You never ever bring food into this little machsan, small machsan and so on. So you have to go down and clean it out for Pesach? No. No. Because it's a makom she'ain machnisim bo chametz. Yeah. That's what the Mishnah is saying. If indeed, this is a subjective call. Every person knows his or her home. So if there's an area where absolutely no food is brought into, that's exactly what the Mishnah is saying. So you don't have to break your head. Makom she'ein machnisim chametz, ein tzarich bedikah.
You have to sell those areas?
You don't have to sell anything. You don't have to sell anything. If there's no chametz, you don't sell. What are you selling? The walls. I mean, so Rashi says, in source number 8, Botkim, why did Chachamim institute bedikat chametz? Shelo yavor ala b'bayimotzei. So to make sure that, you know, you shouldn't get stuck with Bal Yireh Bal Yimatzeh at the end of the day on any level. Which means that what we have here is a series of insurance policies. So on the one hand, Beitul Chametz takes into consideration that from a biblical point of view, it's no longer mine. Well, if it's no longer mine, so I don't violate Bal Yireh Bal Yimatzeh. But maybe Rashi sees that maybe a person won't do bitul chametz. Let's assume he doesn't do it. Then he may be stuck with bal yireh b'yimatzeh. So we have to protect him as well. So it's an insurance policy for somebody who didn't do proper bitul chametz, which means he may have read it in the Haggadah. He didn't know a word what he was saying. You know, there are people who read kol chamira v'chamia dika b'shuti, the chazite, the lo chazite, libatel lev hefke kafra dara. What did I just say? Chinese. Right? They don't know what it is. So that's not bitul. That's not bitul. So Rashi was worried that we're going to have plenty of Jews who either won't do bitul chametz or are going to spit out some text and not really know what it is. So we have to protect them also. So if we force Am Yisrael to do a cleanup, a bedikat chametz, and then in the morning, burning chametz, so now we're protected from bal yireh b'yimatzeh, even if somebody did not properly do bitul chametz. Yeah, faksha.
Does the bitul have to be like a one-time thought that you don't all this stuff?
The bitul is done formally.
No.
It's just a declaration before Pesach. We do it twice, actually. Once after the bedikat chametz, and then we repeat it again after the burning of chametz. And the reason is because we have some chametz left over for breakfast in the morning, and that's perfectly legitimate. So how can you do bitul chametz, and then the next morning you know that you still have some bread? So that's why we cover ourselves with the second bitul. I have to explain why we do both. But anyway, if you take a look in source number 9, the Tosfot brings Rashi, Peihei, Ola Basa Botkinil Chametz. Anybody want to tell me what Peihei means? Pirush Hakuntrus. What does Pirush Hakuntrus mean?
Rashi.
Right, everybody knows that, right? Rashi. Where does Kuntrus come to Rashi? What does Kuntrus mean? The notebook. The notebook. So there was the notebook of Rashi going around, right? Rashi's notebook went viral. Right? Means it was copied. And it wasn't that it was, here, this is Rashi's notebook. No. They copied from Rashi's notebook. So the Tosfot in France, and northern France and in Germany, in Ashkenaz, they were using Rashi's notes. Because they didn't have it like today, a Gemara with Rashi on the side. They had manuscripts of Gemara. And then they had Rashi's notebook. So when they were quoting Rashi, they were quoting the notebook. Now, some of you may have enough experience in learning to know that occasionally the Tosfot will say, a Rashi. So why is it Hakuntrus and sometimes it's Rashi? So we had here in Israel, he was a candidate for third president of Israel, Professor Ephraim Elimelech Urbach, Zichron Levracha, a very big Talmud Chacham, and he was at the Hebrew University, and he wrote a masterful work, a masterpiece, called Balei HaTosafot. It's really the classic work, historical work on the Balei HaTosafot. And he shows that, you know, Tosafot isn't one person, even though as growing up as kids, we always said Tosafot says, and Tosafot asks, like it's a person, Mr. Tosafot. But it's the Balei HaTosafot who ask, and it's not one person. It's a conglomeration of various yeshivot, and it spans 200 years. So there are early Tosafot printed on our page, and later Tosafot. The only thing is, the printers in Vilna didn't have a clue what was early, what was late. So if it says Pirush HaKuntrus, that's already an indication it's an early Tosafot. Because they were still working from the Kuntrus. But that's the 12th century. But in the late 13th century, Rashi was already a known commodity. So they would say, Kashel Rashi, or something like that. It's just an interesting, you know, insight. So here it says Pirush HaKuntrus. So he quotes Rashi, Shelo Yavar Alav B'Bayir B'Yimatzeh. V'Kashel Ri. So Ri is a Kasha. And the Ri says at the end, you know why we have Bidikat Chametz? Because you can do whatever you want in terms of Bidul Chametz, and but if the Chametz is still in your house, you might stumble and eat it. By accident, come of course. The last few words, Shelo Yavo La'ochlo. You might come to eat the Chametz. So what if it's not yours? You're now to eat Chametz of somebody else. You're now to eat Chametz from a Goy. So what? So you disassociated yourself from it. Right? You gave it to a Goy. You sold it to a Goy. But hold on. But you might eat it. This Shelo Yavo La'ochlo is a serious issue with regard to the sale of Chametz. That's why when we sell our Chametz, we tell the people that the chametz has to be stored away in a closet that's not going to be used for Pesach at all. That you are not going to open up that closet for Pesach. And it's in a box that's closed and, you know, sealed, whatever, and you write 5,000 times on it, chametz. You have to really protect yourself that by accident you don't eat the chametz. I remember when Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichron Lebracha, was teaching Pesachim in the Gush, in Yeshiva. So it was in his early years in the Gush. So he said, and we were driving once on Chol HaMoed, and we opened up the glove compartment, and what did we see? Drake's cakes. Drake's cakes. And I'm going to say this in Hebrew, because and I'll translate it. Rav Aaron goes, this is the shir in the Yeshiva. Kamish zachur li ech sheharav ahav et a devil dog. I remember fondly how the Rav used to love devil dogs. You know the Drake's cakes line, right? And the Israeli who says, Harav, mazeh devil dog. Harav, mazeh devil dog. And we Americans have to explain to him the godless of a devil dog.
You know?
A devil dog is Yetzirah on rye, okay? You said that's a devil dog. It's the stuff, the only stuff that I bring home from America. We used to bring home Skippy peanut butter and star kissed tuna fish and other things. You get everything here. You get everything. Not devil dogs. Not ringdings. Not deli. It's chocolate cake with white cream. It's a cake.
It's a hot dog.
It looks like a hot dog. That's what they call a devil dog. Right, looks like a hot dog. Yeah, and then that sure. Yeah, Eretz Yisrael is chaser. It says it has almost everything.
They don't have drakes, but they do have devil dogs.
They have devil dogs.
Yeah, but not the snow. They have the cake.
Right, yeah.
It's not the same.
It's not the same. It's not the same. It's imitation. Ah. Sug bet. That's what it is. It's sug bet that they sell here. Right. Right. Kamish is a chudi, ich rav havet, a devil dog. And it's all in the middle of a shir, you know. Oh, that was the whole point. Right, so what do you do on... So if it's Yom Tov, by the way, if it's Yom Tov, so you have to put a kli on top of it, because it's muksa. Can't do anything. And a cholamoy, you have to burn it. You have to take it out and burn it. And if it's cholamoy, then you just burn it. But are you protected from Bal Yireh Bar Yimatzeh? Of course, because you did Bitul Chametz, and you basically said, any chametz that I didn't find, it's not mine anymore. It's like Hefker. That, you know, did you notice... In the nusach of the Kol Chamira v'Chamia, you're going to take a look in your Haggadahs and see that some Haggadot say, Lehevei Hefker Ka'afrada Ara, and some do not have the word Hefker. Lehevei Ka'afrada Ara. Should be like the dust of the ground. Or it should be Hefker, like the dust of the ground. It's not the same thing. It's the machloket between the Ramban and the Tosfot. Tosfot, sources 12 and 3 to 13. Tosfot said that it's Hefker. And Ramban said it's not Hefker. So that's why the word Hefker was deleted from the Nusa, from the text of the Kol Chamira, to take into consideration the Ramban's view. That it's not an act of Hefker, but it's an act of Yeush. So all these little things become very important halachot. Come very important. Look, I'm sure you all learned this already. Gemara says in Masechet Nida that in utero everybody learned Kol HaTorah Kula. So I'm sure you learned Briska Torah also there, for sure. But then you know the Malach, he gave a little bit of a shmeis under the nose, and some people he hit a little bit too hard. People don't remember anything. The Rav explained once what that Gemara is all about. You know, if you go to a lecture or you go to a shir, you heard the shir. And like all of us, you know, you remember part of it, okay, you take with it. Then 5 years later, somebody goes back to that subject, and you say, ooh, you know, I heard something about this. And it starts coming back to you, you remember it. The Rav said, if we would not have heard the shir from the Malach, we'd never understand anything of Torah. But anytime we study Torah, it's, right, I remember, it's coming back now. So if we heard this once somewhere... It's always recalling. It's always on recall. And it's amazing understanding of this Gemara. Amazing understanding. And by the way, the Gemara there does not distinguish between boys and girls in utero of studying Kol HaTorah Kula. Okay? That's a quote. You can tell it to the whole world. I don't care. That, you know, nobody's going to find... Just like you can't deny the fact that the women stood at Har Sinai. I have a whole shiur on that. Women also stood at Har Sinai, you know, like, yeah. And it wasn't to, you know, to prepare the blintzes, you know, as a night. Okay, there are a few more things on this particular page that I just want to take a look at the end on sources 15, 16, and 17. Masha at the very end. And we're going to go back to this page yet next week because there's a core issue here that we didn't do. So I'm just going to end this with this little idea. Source 15, 16, 17. 15 is the famous medrash on the pasuk Ushmartem et haMatzot. From this pasuk, you should guard the matzot. We learned the halacha of matzah shmura. The matzah shmura is a drasha Shabbat Gadol in its own right because there are two different ideas called matzah shmura. One is that the wheat was protected from becoming in contact with water from the time of the harvest. What's called shmura mishat ketzira. Now, all the matzot that we buy for Pesach are shmura, except that the question is, from when is it guarded? When is it protected? Is it protected from the time that it was ground into wheat, which is called shmura mishat trina, or even at a later stage, for the time that it became contact with water and it made into dough, from then, from that moment on, we are really careful that it doesn't become chametz. That's called shmura mishat lisha. So the regular matzot that we call matzot pshutot that are not with the label shmura are shmura mishat lisha. They're guarded so that from the point of the time that water does come in contact with it, it didn't become chametz. Why am I telling this to you? What happens if Leila said that you don't have quote unquote matzah shmura, but you have regular matzot kasher lePesach? What do you do for Seder night? You eat them because they're also shmura matzah on a different level. That's all. On a lower level of shmura. But you eat them. L'shem matzah's mitzvah, without a doubt. But the chumrah is that it should be shmura mishat ktsira, from the time of the harvest, that no water comes in contact with the wheat, even before it even goes to the mill to be ground into, processed into flour. That's the matzah shmura. The other idea of shmura is that it should be baked l'shem mitzvah. L'shem mitzvah. At the baking, we're not just baking crackers here, but we're baking matzah so that we can fulfill the obligation of eating matzah on Seder night. That's a special, special kavanah. Mm-hmm. And the Rebbe of Sons, Reb Chaim Halberstam, who I will tell you that the Rav told me once that there were two Chaims in the 19th century we're talking about. One was obviously his grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav of Brisk, and the other, to my astonishment, was the Sons of Rav, the Rebbe of Sons, Reb Chaim Halberstam. The Rav had tremendous admiration for the Reb Chaim Halberstam, the author of the Divrei Chaim, and he was a Chassidish Rebbe, but a tremendous Talmid Chacham. I had a great uncle who lived in Kiryat Sanz in Netanya, and I went to visit him back in 72, and his address was Rehov Divrei Chaim number 1, which was okay, that's the name of the Svarim of the Sons of Rav. And I found out that every street was Rehov Divrei Chaim, the perpendicular. So how do you figure out where you go? So I asked the chassid on the street, you know, once, where's Divrei Chaim 1? I mean, this is Divrei Chaim. So he tells me, Dusa Chaylik Aleph and Dusa Chaylik Beis. It's Chaylik Aleph and Chaylik Bet. You know, everything is Rehov Divrei Chaim, you know. Because there were different, you know, volume 1, volume 2. Let's say that. So the Divrei Chaim came out vehemently opposed to machine matzahs for a variety of reasons. One of his reasons was that a machine cannot have kavanah for matzah mitzvah. Only a human being can do that. And okay, that's why many Hasidim till this very day will, for least for Seder night, use hand matzahs, and some will use hand matzahs for the whole Pesach. Beseder, that's okay, I'm not challenging that. But other Paiskim thought otherwise, that the operator of the machine can also have kavanah for matzah mitzvah, which is exactly what's done at the machine matzah factories till this very day. So that's Ushmartem et haMatzot. But what's the drash? Rabbi Yoshe Omer.
Rabbi, does that mean that when Hasidim are making Shmur Matzah on Pesach, that they have the idea that the rolling pin has no idea of the...
The Kavanah is when you take the matzah before, the pre-baked matzah, and you shove it into the oven. And there you say, L'shem matzat mitzvah. It's a human act. It's a human act.
But it's only on that act. That
That's right.
The other, not right. what leads up.
Correct. 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 So the drash of Rabbi Yosha is Al tikre kein ella ushmartem et ha-mitzvot. Play on the word matzot, mitzvot. Kederach she'ein machmitzin et ha-matzah, just like you don't let the matzah sour, kach lo yachmitzu et ha-mitzvot. Ela imba mitzvah liyadcha ase ota miyad. Or in a more popular expression, mitzvah haba liyadcha al tachamitzena. A mitzvah that comes by your way, don't let it get sour. Which means don't miss the opportunity. Don't miss the opportunity. And to this end, the Rav spoke in length on his famous Yom HaTzma'ut speech in 1956, called the Didofeg, about not missing opportunities. You know what? I'm going to begin with this mitzvah next week. And so we'll use this page. We'll use this page for next week as well. So you can leave it in the back and I'll be happy to bring it. Yeah.
You mentioned about clicking by a poster.